days, life before disruption. I like to laugh at myself as I huff and puff and proclaim these to be times of unprecedented exponential change. I love Henry Mintzberg's wonderful line, "It is the conceit of every age to say that we live in confusing times compared to the placid age the prior generation experienced." Madness is the watchword of 2018, but my mom, Evelyn Peters, 1909 to 2005, lived through rather turbulent times as well. The Model T, cell phones, satellites, TV, TV dinners, microwave ovens, jets, the Great Depression, Ty Cobb, Babe Ruth, Derek Jeter, the Civil Rights Movement, Gay Pride, women's suffrage, Gandhi, Oklahoma and New Mexico and Arizona and Hawaii and Alaska become states, Churchill, World War I, World War II, the Holocaust, the A-bomb, the H-bomb, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Iraq War, 9/11, the Cold War, the disintegration of the USSR, William Howard Taft, just missed Teddy Roosevelt, FDR, Ronald Reagan, mainframe computers, PCs, the iPod, the Internet, air conditioning, weed whackers, Mickey Mouse, Frank Sinatra, Elvis, the Beatles, Madonna, Nancy Drew, the first five Harry Potter books, antibiotics, MRIs, polio vaccine, genetic mapping, man on the moon, more or less permanent space station. But, alas, she didn't live long enough to see the Cubs win another World Series or take a selfie. I will not retract a word in this chapter on madcap change, but I will acknowledge that we are not the first to experience a ceaseless string of immodest disruptions. Your call, but I'd stack the madness of my mom's 95 years with what's on the plate today. Section 2. The New Moral Imperative. My story. After Peter Drucker's death, numerous organizations could have been the first to host a conference to celebrate his life's work as the pioneer of modern management thinking. The one that took the lead position was the Australian Institute of Management. Likewise, a lot of people could have been selected to give the keynote speech at that conference, but I was the one who got the nod. That was a bit odder than you might think. Mr. Drucker had never been much of a fan of my work, In Search of Excellence in particular. He thought Bob Waterman and I were playing to the masses and being mere popularizers of what he viewed as a very serious subject. The fact is, I took and take Dr. Drucker very seriously, and AIM placed an enormous weight on my shoulders in handing me the opening talk at this landmark event. Can I put it in plain English? I was scared shitless and had no idea what to say that would live up to the event's gravitas and stellar attendee list that included Doris Drucker, Peter's wife and very active partner. As usual, I went to the books. In this instance, Drucker's early work in particular. I had been, perhaps, a typical Drucker reader. I'd glommed on to this message or that. For example, Drucker's riff on planning. In particular, managers need to take an hour out to think every day had been my early career lodestone in my 2 years, 1969 and 1970, in the Pentagon as a junior U.S. Navy officer. I had cherry-picked and vastly oversimplified. I had woefully shortchanged the philosophical underpinnings of Drucker's corpus. What I discovered in my deep Drucker immersion is what I call the moral basis of management. Drucker was a refugee from Hitler, and he thought deeply about the human condition. My deep Drucker dive helped with preparing my speech and then seeped into everything I've subsequently done. I don't believe in magical writing, but as I pondered and pondered the AIM talk, at one point my computer keyboard more or less seemed to independently produce the following, in time transferred to PowerPoint presentation slides. Organizations exist to serve, period. Leaders live to serve, period. Passionate servant leaders, determined to create a legacy of earth-shaking transformation in their domain, a 600-square-foot retail space, four-person training department, an urban school, a rural school, whatever, must necessarily create organizations which are no less than cathedrals, in which the full and awesome power of the imagination and spirit and native entrepreneurial flair of diverse individuals is unleashed in passionate pursuit of a jointly perceived soaring purpose, worthy of bragging about 25 years from now to your grandkids, and personal and community and client service excellence. Organizations as cathedrals for human development. But true, damn it. I am pleased to report that the talk was well received, including by Mrs. Drucker. Perhaps in her nightly prayer, she reported to her late husband that I wasn't quite the rube he had imagined me to be. This Drucker-inspired PN to Service and Human Development was written, as indicated above, in 2007. Reflect now on the first section of this chapter covering the tech tsunami and the white-collar apocalypse. With the wave of change bearing down on us, there is, as I see it, a new moral requirement of the utmost urgency to prepare all our team members for a madcap world in which only continuous, radical growth increases the odds of professional survival. Hence, the moral imperative narrative. 7.2.1. People first, a moral imperative. Corporate mandate, your mandate 2018. Your principal moral obligation as a leader is to develop the skill set of every one of the people in your charge, including semi-permanent and temporary, to the maximum extent of your abilities and consistent with their revolutionary needs in the years ahead. The bonus, this is also the premier profit maximization strategy. The employment contract, as we've known it for the last 50 years, is permanently severed. What will take its place? Certainly not job security in any form that resembles the past. Only sustained personal development will possibly stand up to the seismic forces at work. Thus, developing one's associates is now indeed a moral imperative and the first imperative. As suggested, however, the good business news is that it's also a precursor of enterprise durability and financial success. 7.2.2. Superior work environments are possible and profitable in every corner of the economy. 1998 to 2014. Fortune reported that just 12 enterprises had been on its list of 100 best companies to work for in the United States every year, for all 16 years of that list's existence. Along the way, among other things, the Super 12 created 341,567 new jobs. That amounts to job growth of 172%. Shareholder returns for the publicly traded companies also dramatically outpaced the market as a whole. The 12. Publix, Whole Foods, Wegmans, Nordstrom, Marriott, REI, Four Seasons, Cisco Systems, Goldman Sachs, SAS Institute, W.L. Gore, TD Industries. Big note. Fully 7 out of the 12, the first 7 on the list, of the best of the 100 best, are in so-called necessarily low-wage components of the service industry. Performance example. Retail turnover in general, 65%. Publix in groceries, in the first one on the list, had turnover of 5%. 7.2.2.1. The Super 12's super secret. Part-timers are full-time members of the family. Relative to the 2016 version of the best to work for list, Fortune reported that the Super 12 have one thing in common. They take generous care of their part-timers. At some of the companies on the full list of top performers, the share of part-timers is low. But among the 7 of 12 that are in industries such as hotels and retail, the numbers are sky high. Whole Foods, for example, has 27,000 part-timers. Nordstrom has 30,000. And Publix has a staggering 100,000. Perhaps the most important commonality and indicator of corporate philosophy, among the 12 is that they all offer part-timers health care benefits, and most give part-timers paid time off for sick days, holidays, and so on. Nordstrom's part-timers, for example, have 19 paid days off. Marriott's have 18 paid days off, and REI's have 12. Other examples of treating part-timers as full-time members of the family include Publix's, again, policy of making part-timers eligible for employee stock ownership plans that fund retirement savings. Dare I ask, are your part-timers treated as full-time members of the family? 7.2.3. One more. The Good Jobs Strategy. In the book The Good Jobs Strategy, author and MIT professor Zeynep Tan reinforces the point made above about the 7 employee-friendly superstars in theoretically low-wage, low-benefit industries. Contrary to conventional corporate thinking, treating retail workers much better may make everyone, including their employers, much richer. One of Tan's primary exemplars, Costco, offers average hourly pay of $20.89, which is 40% greater than its number one competitor, Sam's Club. Professor Tan persuasively argues that an obsession with developing people in retail is as important as it is at Google, and it pays, as firms such as Costco demonstrate. 7.2.4. Least likely, best places to work award. Tea plantations. The greatest satisfaction for management has come not from the financial growth of Camellia itself, but rather from having participated in the vast improvement in the living and working conditions of its employees, resulting from the investment of many tens of millions of pounds into the tea garden's infrastructure of roads, factories, hospitals, employees' housing, and amenities. Above all, there is a deep concern for the welfare of each employee. This arises not only from a sense of humanity, but also from the conviction that the loyalty of a secure and enthusiastic employee will, in the long term, prove to be an invaluable company asset. Camellia, a very different company. Camellia, Latin for tea, is based in London. While the firm includes manufacturing, distribution, and a financial services arm, among other assets, it sprung from the tea business and is today the world's second largest private tea producer. A couple of years ago, Camellia had revenues of $600 million and after-tax earnings of approximately $100 million. The tea business can be an extraordinarily good commercial venture. In the book extract above, Camellia's leadership attributes that effectiveness directly to employee and community development. Presumably, if you are like me, you do not think of tea plantation and unwavering long-term commitment to employee development in the same breath. Well, think again. I urge you to pass this quote out and perhaps reread it weekly. The significance borders on biblical. Do the right thing for our people. Startling results follow, regardless of industry. 7.2.5. Oath of Office, Managers, Servant Leaders. Our goal is to serve our customers brilliantly and profitably over the long haul. Serving our customers brilliantly and profitably over the long haul is a product of brilliantly serving over the long haul the people who serve the customer. Hence, our job as leaders, the Alpha and the Omega and everything in between, is abetting the sustained growth and success and engagement and enthusiasm and commitment to excellence of those, one at a time, who directly or indirectly serve the ultimate customer. We, leaders of every stripe, are in the human growth and development and success and aspiration to excellence business. We leaders only grow when each and every one of our colleagues are growing. We leaders only succeed when each and every one of our colleagues are succeeding. We leaders only energetically march toward excellence when each and every one of our colleagues are energetically marching toward excellence. Period. This, too, was a byproduct of my AIM speech. My oath of office was not an attempt to mimic Drucker's ideas, but it was offered in the spirit of his profoundly important work, and it is literally meant as a formal oath of office, however grandiose that may seem at first blush. 7.2.6. Seven steps to sustaining success. You take care of the people. The people take care of the service. The service takes care of the customer. The customer takes care of the profit. The profit takes care of the reinvestment. The reinvestment takes care of the reinvention. The reinvention takes care of the future. And at every step, the only measure is excellence. And it all starts with you taking care of the people. 7.2.7. The committed leader's guaranteed multiplier. The law of large numbers. If you, for example, project manager, training department chief, work your one ass off helping your team members succeed and grow, they will work their 10 asses off making you successful. 7.2.8. The Tim Russert story. And yours? In a way, the world is a great liar. It shows you it worships and admires money, but at the end of the day, it doesn't. It says that it adores fame and celebrity, but it doesn't, not really. The world admires and wants to hold on to and not lose goodness. It admires virtue. At the end, it gives its greatest tributes to generosity, honesty, courage, mercy, talents well used, talents that, brought into the world, make it better. That's what it really admires. That's what we talk about in eulogies because that's what's important. We don't say, the thing about Joe was, he was rich. We say, if we can, the thing about Joe was, he took care of people. Peggy Noonan, A Life's Lesson on the Life and Legacy of Journalist Tim Russert. The Wall Street Journal, June 20th, 2008. A wonderful story for the ages, a requisite leadership excellence imperative for 2018. Chapter 8. Job Security in an Insecure World. My story. There's Fritz Roethlisberger and the Hawthorne experiments, and Elton Mayo. Roethlisberger and Mayo were the godfathers of the employee involvement movement that actually dates back to the 1940s and their studies of ways to improve productivity at Western Electric's massive Hawthorne works outside of Chicago. There were, over the years, many flavors. Participative management, self-managed teams, in modern times, a dozen varieties of empowerment. None of these really works for me. Empowerment, for example, seems condescending in a way. I've generously decided to let you occasionally think for yourself. Now segue to 1993. In 1993, in the Tom Peters seminar, I went my own way, and it was meant to signal a leap in independent thinking and acting on the part of the average worker. The moniker was Every Person a Business Person, or my ugly version, Businessing Every Job. The idea was this. Already in the early 90s, competition was heating up, white-collar automation was digging in a little deeper, and outsourcing was gathering way. I viewed it as a big, lots-more-to-come-within-a-decade threat, and put it this way. Apologies for quoting myself. You, worker, will no longer survive as Hewlett-Packard badge 2319 who shows up on time. You will need to think more independently. Think like a more or less independent, holistic, a cringeworthy word, but it's appropriate here, business person, rather than a mostly invisible employee, even reliable employee. I added that this indirectly, pretty damn directly actually, amounts to a huge win for the employer, everyone thinking in wholes instead of parts, thinking about the business, not just her or his 100 square feet of turf. That part of the story was a surprisingly hard sell. A bunch of folks with entrepreneurial bents running around was not exactly every boss's dream. In the seminar book, I made this the topic of an entire chapter titled Beyond Empowerment, Turning Every Job into a Business. I spelled out what I thought 100% of us thinking like a business person meant. Then, somewhere along the way, the businessing idea morphed into Brand You. It took wings in the August-September 1997 issue of Fast Company, then a young magazine. Its cover story, with my byline, was titled, The Brand Called You. The cover was a vividly colored rendering of a box of Tide detergent. The idea was that you and I and the brand called Tide were one and the same. The response to the article was off the charts, and it still is 20 years later. When, for example, I look at my 2018 tweet stream, the reference to the 1997 article shows up regularly. I still think more than ever, that 25 brand use in a 25-person company is the ultimate win for that company. Or it can be. 25 folks hell-bent on growth with the boss supporting them can or will result, for instance, in a stunning commitment to the customer and continuous do-or-die innovation. Brand U was born amid and became associated with the excesses of the me decade, as the 90s were sometimes called. To be sure, Brand U does indeed call for significant distinction in your work and a commitment to radical personal growth. These are survival requisites for all of us, age 22 to 82. But self-centeredness is precisely the wrong way to go. It is, in fact, the kiss of death. The logic is simple. You are increasingly on your own. Job security for that hard-working soul, badge 2319, is DOA. Sucking up to the boss is a loser strategy. The boss's job is likely to go before yours as companies flatten their hierarchies and dump middle managers by the busload. Hence, being an effective brand you in 2018 means shifting your focus 90 degrees from vertical to horizontal. The emphasis shifts from suck up to suck sideways to becoming a highly valued, nay, irreplaceable collaborator. Your future is a byproduct of the word of mouth or mouse reputation associated with your name. And make no mistake, a stellar word of mouth rep is primarily based on the horizontal supportiveness of your peers and your customers and other outsiders. Today, every person is a business person, or else. Every person is distinctly good at something, or else. Every person is a professional development maniac, or else. Every person lives off her or his network of peers and customers, or else. And we ain't seen nothing yet is gross understatement. The Job Security 2018 Narrative. 8.1, Dancing in the Rain. Life is not about waiting for the storm to pass. It's about learning to dance in the rain. Ted Rubin. Welcome, boys and girls, friends and foes, left-handers and right-handers, to 2018. 8.2.1. The age of ubiquitous brand you and the unassailable necessity of personal differentiation. One of its defining characteristics, globalization and web-driven innovation, is that it will be less driven by countries or corporations and more driven by real people. It will unleash unprecedented creativity, advancement of knowledge, and economic development. But at the same time, it will tend to undermine safety net systems and penalize the unskilled. Clyde Prestowitz, 3 Billion New Capitalists. The new organization of society implied by the triumph of individual autonomy and the true equalization of opportunity based upon merit will lead to very great rewards for merit and great individual autonomy. This will leave individuals far more responsible for themselves than they have been accustomed to being during the industrial period. It will also precipitate transition crises, including a possible severe economic depression that will reduce the unearned advantage in living standards that has been enjoyed by residents of advanced industrial societies throughout the 20th century. James Davidson and William Rees Moog, The Sovereign Individual. The ecosystem used to funnel lots of talented people into a few clear winners. Now it's funneling lots of talented people into lots of experiments. Tyler Willis, business developer, to Nathan Heller, Baywatched, How San Francisco's New Entrepreneurial Culture is Changing the Country, The New Yorker, October the 14th, 2013. Career has a radically altered meaning. It does not play out within the bounds of a single or even a small number of employers. Commitment to breakneck speed, perpetual learning and growth is a lifetime requirement for one and all. A supportive labor market legal framework that deals with the likes of gigs and brief associations with companies is barely gathering way. For example, Uber's high-frequency legal tussles over employee benefits. Education is woefully misguided. Pretty much everything is up for grabs. 8.2.2. Distinct or extinct. We use this, distinct or extinct, on t-shirts and posters in my brand new seminars. Are there exceptions to all this? There are surely different paces in different places, but true exceptions? Simply put, I don't think so. If there is nothing very special about your work, no matter how hard you apply yourself, you won't get noticed, and that increasingly means you won't get paid much either. Michael Goldhaber, Wired. More of the same. The rule of positioning. If you can't describe your position in 8 words or less, you don't have a position. Jay Levinson and Seth Godin, Get What You Deserve. And more. And on it could go. 8.3.1. Sally Helgeson's De Facto Brand U Roadmap. Sally Helgeson, author of the widely acclaimed book, The Female Advantage, Women's Ways of Leadership, returned to the fray with Thriving in 24/7. In the crazy new Security is Dead world, she argues that professional survival will require a newly constructed package of skills. The bedrock. Start at the core. Nimbleness is only possible if we locate our inner voice, take regular inventory of where we are. Learn to zigzag. Think gigs. Think lifelong learning. Forget old loyalty. Work on optimism. Create our own work. Articulate your value. Integrate your passions. ID your market. Run your own business. Weave a strong web of inclusion. Build your own support network and develop a reputation as a network builder. I think that in a very few words, Ms. Helgeson precisely captures the spirit of this chapter's argument. 8.3.2. New World. New Work Survival Kit, 2018. Here with my version of Sally Helgeson's list above. 1. Mastery. Absurdly good at something. 2. Your legacy. All work equals memorable, braggable, wow projects. 3. USP. Unique selling proposition. That old favorite, USP, applies to each of us in 2018. 4. Networking obsession. From vertical loyalty to horizontal loyalty. 5. Entrepreneurial instinct. A sleepless eye for opportunity. A small, actually there is no such thing as small, opportunity for independent action beats a faceless part of a monster project. 6. CEO, leader, business person, closer, CEO of Me, Inc. 7. Mistress of improv. Play a dozen parts simultaneously, from chief strategist to chief toilet scrubber. 8. Intense appetite for technology. For example, are you a leading-edge, fanatical user of social media? 9. Embrace marketing. You are your own CSO, Chief Storytelling Officer. 10. Obsessed with renewal. Your own CLO, Chief Learning Officer. 11. Execution fanaticism. Show up early, leave late, sweat the details, tuck the shower curtain in. 12. Excellence, period. What else? If not this list, one like it. Brand you as an alpha to omega affair. 8.4. Brand you equals team sport. First order of business, your reputation with your peers. The brand you idea, as noted in the chapter introduction, was seen by many as selfish. That is, you or me attempting to trot out our wares, hog the spotlight, and elbow others out of the way. Nothing could be further from the truth. You must indeed be very good and noteworthy in terms of a useful skill, but, at least as important, you must also be seen as a superb teammate. Truth be known, when Jane Jones is assessing you as a helpmate for her next independent gig, your reputation as a supportive team player and the breadth and health of your external network may well outweigh your technical skills. So, first you must be a great teammate. Give yourself a score on this every day, that's my suggestion. By which I mean, for example, did you go out of your way, at some cost and time, to give someone a helping hand with something? Second, you must invest a substantial amount of time and emotional effort, lots and lots and lots, in networking. Remember Ms. Helgeson's commandment, weave a strong web of inclusion. 8.5. Retool or perish. The illiterate of the 21st century will not be those who cannot read or write, but those who cannot learn, unlearn, and relearn. Alvin Toffler. Knowledge becomes obsolete incredibly fast. The continuing professional education of adults is the number one growth industry in the next 30 years. Peter Drucker. Brand you brand equity. Your specialist appreciation rate per annum, 15%, 25%. Regardless, it is imperative that you develop a formal investment strategy. Personal Dictate 2018. You must invest in skill development. You must have a renewal investment plan. It must be formal. It must be bold. You must self-schedule a routine personal brand you audit. 8.6. Getting started today. Number 1. When you wake up, imagine that you are self-employed. Are you ready? Are you organized? Are your priorities clear? Have you got an achievable to-do list? Pare it down some more, and then more. Are you clear about how to approach the first item on your list? Most of all, is your attitude what it needs to be? Success depends on your demeanor from the opening bell. Professional, friendly, cheerful, organized. Number 2. Reconsider the project you are working on. Does it have pizzazz? Can it have more pizzazz? The job or task may have been pretty damn mundane and you may have been treating it accordingly, but my experience is that 9 out of 9 times you can add new twists here and there, get a couple of other people involved to widen the project's impact, and so on. I call this moving up the wow scale. Are the immediate milestones clear and achievable? If it is a team project, does everyone feel ownership? Are you crystal clear as to who the customers are and what their expectations are? Think customers. Every project of 1 day or 1 year's duration has customers. Number 3, lunch. Lunch is the day's opportunity number 1. Are you going to lunch with pals, or are you going with someone new whose brain you can pick about this, that, or the other, and who you can add to your network? Your pals are great and a blessing. But in this new world order, I suggest that 50 to 75% of your lunches should be calculated learning and network development and maintenance opportunities. Number 4. Homework. Do you have a weekly or monthly professional development plan? In less imposing terms, a list of stuff you want to learn and a to-do list for learning it. Number 5. Etc. This list is meant to be a rough thought starter and pot stirrer. It is not holy writ. 8.7. Parting thoughts on brand you. All human beings are entrepreneurs. When we were in caves, we were all self-employed, finding our food, feeding ourselves. That's where human history began. As civilization came, we suppressed it. We became labor because they stamped us. You are labor. We forgot that we are entrepreneurs. Muhammad Yunus, Nobel laureate and father of microlending. Entrepreneurial, Yunus asserts, is not a term reserved for the elite with version 2018 technical degrees from Stanford or MIT. Look around you. Your neighbor, the freelance writer next door working from her spare bedroom. The electrician down the street. The interior decorator in the next block. Ordinary in the best sense of the word. And full-fledged, excellence or bust, entrepreneurs in every sense of those words. My personal breakthrough on this came in a so-called green room in New York in 1999. I was about to go on the CBS morning show to talk about brand you, soon after my book by that title had been published. In my mind, I pictured the viewer as a white-collar cubicle slave off to another dreary day in the office. It seemed rather ludicrous to imagine him or her as an entrepreneur. And, thinking back to my days in Palo Alto, entrepreneur meant browser developer Mark Andreessen or Sun Microsystems crazy founder Scott McNeely. But then my mind shifted to my farm in Vermont in the week before my trip to New York. There had been an electrical problem, and our electrician and an assistant had driven out to fix it. There was also a stinky septic problem, and I, by the way, had been working with a solo Boston editor on a magazine article. All of these people were genuine entrepreneurs, brand yous working on their own or with a very small team, probably supported by an hour-a-week bookkeeper who took care of business issues. These were normal folks, the de facto people next door, and they all wanted glowing word-of-mouth recommendations to keep on going. No, entrepreneur or brand you was not just some wild-eyed Silicon Valley PhD-toting inventor. It was that metaphorical neighbor, and brand you was indeed an achievable end. Last words. You are the storyteller of your own life, and you can create your own legend, or not. Isabel Allende. Carpenters bend wood. Fletchers bend arrows, wise men fashion themselves. Buddha. Section 4. Innovation. Chapter 9. Innovation 1. Whoever tries the most stuff wins. Whoever screws the most stuff up wins. My story. Grab a pair of garden clippers and go forth. Call it the summer of brush cutting, but it turned out to be so much more. Much, much more. It started as a simple task, cleaning out some annoying brambles on a walking path, an irritating item to be checked off the spring to-do list. So off I went with minimal enthusiasm. A day or two later, scratches from head to toe, I had an intriguing sense of accomplishment. Rooting around for hours on end in the bramble patch, I saw things I'd never seen before. So I tentatively expanded my effort to clearing a little addition to the main path, aiming to get a better view of one of Evermont farm ponds. The next bit somehow revealed something else to my continuing surprise. Then at a casual dinner, I sat next to a landscaper, and we got to talking about our farm and my nascent skills with hand clippers, handsaw, and so on. In particular, she suggested that I do some clearing around a few of our big boulders. Start a second career as a rock sculptor, she said with a laugh. Amused by her comment, I set about that boulder clearing on our main trail, and I was again surprised, rather taken aback, actually, by the striking result, if there was a sort of second career here. My growing artistry led to attacking some dense brush and brambles around some barely visible rocks that had often caught my attention, which, then, as the iterations accelerated, led to finding, in effect, a great place for a more or less Zen garden, as we subsequently came to call it, which led to more and more, and more, surprise after surprise after surprise, especially a massive rock outcropping I unveiled on a steep hillside featuring three towering somber granite faces I call the Cardinal, the Pope, and the Monsignor. A good friend, the Catholic priest from Chicago, informally blessed the trio. To make a long story short, I proceeded by trial and error and instinct, and each experiment signaled possibilities for another experiment or two or ten, and to a greater understanding and appreciation of overall potential. The kind of sort of plan, though there was none, in fact made itself, and it was far, far better, more ambitious, more interesting, more satisfying than I would have imagined. In fact, the result bore zero resemblance to what I was thinking about at the start, a trivial self-designed chore that became the engine of a decade's at-home activities. With a nod to my landscaper friend, I called my imaginary one-person outfit the Rock Revelations Corporation. Note, we recently moved from Vermont to Massachusetts and the process began to repeat itself, this time in a sizable patch of wetlands. I guess I need to rename my venture. I suspect that your interest in Tom's Vermont brush-cutting thing may be modest at best. The point here, obviously, is much more general. J.J.I. Just jump in. There was no grand plan. There was no plan at all. The starting point was starting. Starting a boring task with about a week's expected duration. The doing grew into something totally different from anything I could have imagined at the start. As I see it, the mini-saga of Tom's brush-cutting transformation, I ordinarily dislike that grandiose T-word transformation, but it's merited here, is in fact the basic story of innovation in general. The Nobel-winning economist F.A. Hayek said the secret of market-driven capitalistic economic growth is what he labeled a, quote, spontaneous discovery process, unquote. I expect no Nobel, but what I just described was indeed a textbook spontaneous discovery process, and it surely, from its insignificant beginnings, upended my life. Now I hope to upend yours. Off we go to the land of WTTMSW. Whoever tries the most stuff wins. The WTTMSW Narrative. 9.1. Innovation 1. WTTMSW, whoever tries the most stuff wins. I'm in the habit of saying that this, WTTMSW, the lead item in this chapter, is the only thing I've learned for sure in the last 50 years. Here's what I mean. My training is scientific, and science's axiom number one is that nothing is for certain or settled, and that for every hypothesis there is a competing hypothesis, or 10 or 20, waiting in the wings. That makes sense, except in this instance. I can find no counter-hypothesis to the notion of WTTMSW, whoever tries the most stuff wins. Consider several manifestations of my WTTMSW story. 9.1.1. WTTMSW. Ross Perot versus GM. Ross Perot founded Electronic Data Systems, which was the first of the big systems software houses. He eventually sold the giant firm to General Motors. Describing the differences between the two enterprises, Perot said that the EDS strategy was ready, fire, aim. GM's, by contrast, he claimed, was ready, aim, 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 aim. The try it fast mantra has in recent times become the mainstay in Silicon Valley software firms. The Valley manifestations of the WTTMSW doctrine actually started up north, in Seattle, where Microsoft's alternative to Apple's perfectionism was to launch with blazing speed big systems updates, often significantly flawed, and then they'd correct the at-launch problems with an endless stream of rapid upgrades. That strategy, among other things, brought and sustained for decades an operating system market share of above 80%. Microsoft once bailed Apple out with a large loan aimed at keeping Steve Jobs' firm alive to avoid Microsoft becoming a real rather than de facto monopoly, and even more in the sights of the federal trust busters than was normally the case. Here's my historical take on WTTMSWRFA. 1950 to 1980, age of GM, RAF, ready, aim, fire. 1981 to 2000, age of Microsoft, RFA, ready, fire, aim. 2000 to 2000 and question mark, age of Google, Facebook, you, me, FFF, fire, fire, fire. More flavors of WTTMSW. 9.1.2, WTTMSW, Napoleon. En s'engage et puis on voit. One jumps into the fray, then figures out what to do next. Napoleon. 9.1.3, WTTMSW, Richard Branson. Screw it, let's do it. Lessons in life. Richard Branson, book title. 9.1.4, WTTMSW, Johann Sebastian Bach. Malcolm Gladwell authored a New Yorker article titled Creation Myth. In the myth-busting part of the piece, he ups the de facto WTTMSW ante by suggesting it even holds in the heavens, that is, in the stratospheric world of J.S. Bach. The difference between Bach and his forgotten peers isn't necessarily that he had a better ratio of hits to misses. The difference is that the mediocre might have a dozen ideas, while Bach, in his lifetime, created more than 1,000 full-fledged musical compositions. A genius is a genius, psychologist Paul Simonton maintains, because he can put together such a staggering number of insights, ideas, theories, random observations, and unexpected connections that he almost inevitably ends up with something great. Quality, Simonton writes, is a probabilistic function of quantity. At the time of Steve Jobs' death, several tributes referred to Jobs as a great tinkerer, akin to Thomas Edison. He did not pull a great invention out of thin air. Instead, he took some eighth-baked idea and tinkered and tinkered and tinkered his way to near perfection. More or less, WTTMSW or Bachian quality is a probabilistic function of quantity. 9.1.5. WTTMSW, Joe Murray's Nobel. My summer neighbor several years back was Joe Murray, recipient of a Nobel Prize in Medicine for performing the first successful organ transplant. I once, half-joking, asked, "So what's your secret?" He replied with a smile, "We did more procedures." That is, while his peers theorized, Dr. Joe headed for the OR, put on his surgeon's gown and gloves, asked the head nurse for his scalpel, and went to work. More time in the operating room, more tries, WTTMSW, mantelpiece ornament, Nobel Prize. 9.1.6, WTTMSW, Herb Kelleher on strategy. Southwest Airlines founder Herb Kelleher offers his version of WTTMSW. We have a strategy at Southwest. It's called doing things. 9.1.7, WTTMSW, I wanna be. I want to be a photographer. Take a ton of photos, start a photo blog, organize an art show for your best work, make stuff. I want to be a writer. Write a ton of pieces, establish a voice on social media, start a blog, write guest posts for friends, make stuff. Talk is cheap. Just Make Stuff. Reed Shilperut, brand strategist, on the, quote, one piece of advice, unquote, that has helped him overcome creative blocks. Variation on a theme, butt in chair. Anne Lamott, how to write, butt in chair. Start each day anywhere. Let yourself do it badly. Just take one passage at a time. Get butt back in chair. 9.2. WTTMSW. Action and Excellence. In Search of Excellence, 1982. The Bedrock 8 Basics. 1. A bias for action. 2. Close to the customer. 3. Autonomy and entrepreneurship. 4. Productivity through people. 5. Hands-on, value-driven. 6. Stick to the knitting. 7. Simple form, lean staff. 8. Simultaneous, loose, tight properties. In Search of Excellence was organized around 8 basics of success and excellence. Pride of place went to a bias for action. And so it would be times 10 or times 100 in a rewrite in 2018. To repeat, WTTMSW, QED. I am quite serious when I claim WTTMSW is the only thing I know for sure. 9.3. WTTMSW, Serious Play. MIT Media Lab stalwart Michael Schrage wrote an important book called Serious Play, The Basic Thesis. You can't be a serious innovator unless and until you are ready, willing, and able to seriously play. Serious play is not an oxymoron. It is the essence of innovation. This idea, serious play, is indeed worthy of an entire book. WTTMSW is relatively easy to describe, and it's also relatively easy to make a strong case for it. But there is a big catch. WTTMSW requires a WTTMSW culture. And at the heart of that culture, I believe, is a pervasive spirit of playfulness. To perhaps state the obvious, play in no way suggests a lack of seriousness or purpose. It speaks instead to teammates taking immense pleasure in the messy process of many approximations and wrong turns and dead ends on the way to market. Note, problem and opportunity. Alas, and more to come. Playful is hardly the word that comes to mind when one conjures up the purchasing or HR department, particularly in a giant firm. Yet, in 2018, enterprise survival demands constant innovation, hence playfulness, from those units as much as from the marketing and new product gangs. Serious play, wobbling toward serendipity. The late Robert Altman was once asked how, when filming, he knew when enough was enough. He replied, "We normally shoot a few takes, even if the first one is terrific, because what I'm really hoping for is a mistake. I think that most of the really great moments in my films were not planned. They were things that naturally occurred, and we said, 'Wow, look at that. That's something we want to keep.' That's when you hit the truth button with the audience." The three P's of serious play. Elliot Mazie is the pioneer's pioneer of e-learning. He was once asked how he moved forward in his work. He replied, "I want a sandbox partner." My translation, playmate, playpen, prototype. The playmate can be an interesting client, an innovative small supplier, in a large enterprise, a like-minded insider. As to the playpen, if, again, you are in a sizable enterprise, the golden rule is the further from headquarters and beady-eyed bureaucrats typically therein, the better. As to prototyping, see the next section. Serious play. Measure it. Scale of 1 to 10. How would you rate your organization on devotion to serious play? This is a query of the utmost strategic importance. Organization here may mean a giant firm, and it also might mean a 10-person training department or a 50-person logistics department. The idea, a recurring theme in this book, knows no bounds. 9.4. WTTMSW, A Culture of Prototyping. More wisdom from Michael Schrage. Effective prototyping may be the most valuable core competence an innovative organization can hope to have. Gospel as far as I'm concerned. But the critical notion is accompanied by the usual problem surfaced above. The implementation issue is cultural. I've not found a more lucid translation of the prototyping idea than is provided here by Michael Bloomberg in his book, Bloomberg by Bloomberg. We made mistakes, of course. Most of them were omissions we didn't think of when we initially wrote the software. We fixed them by doing it over and over, again and again. We do the same today. While our competitors are still sucking their thumbs trying to make the design perfect, we're already on prototype version number 5. By the time our rivals are ready with wires and screws, we are on version 10. It gets back to planning versus acting. We act from day one. Others plan how to plan for months. One more take, courtesy of Nicholas Negroponte. Demo or die. This was the approach championed by Negroponte that vaulted his MIT Media Lab to the forefront of IT multimedia innovation. It was his successful alternative to the traditional academic publish or perish. Negroponte's rapid prototyping version was emblematic of the times and the pace and the enormity of the opportunity. 9.5. WTTMSW, Worldwide Winning Hand. Success tactic number 1. Experiment fearlessly. Business Week. Type A organization strategies. How to hit a moving target. Yes, Business Week gave it the number 1 ranking on the success tactics list. Relentless trial and error. The Wall Street Journal on the most effective approach to adjusting company portfolios in the face of changing and uncertain global economic conditions. These two assessments describe WTTMSW at the highest level, the engine of overall economic success. Fact: capitalism equals WTTMSW. Recall my reference to F.A. Hayek's spontaneous discovery process in the chapter opening vignette. 9.6.1. WTTMSW. Corollary number 1. Fail faster, succeed sooner. WSTMSUW. Whoever screws the most stuff up wins. The idea is straightforward. If trying a lot of things at a breakneck pace is innovation success key number 1, then screwing things up at a breakneck pace is part and parcel of the story. The issue raised by this assertion is straightforward, too. Starting at home and in kindergarten, research shows that the use of the word no exceeds the use of the word yes by as much as an order of magnitude. Coming out of the starting gate, don't screw it up, alas, wins out over screw-ups are normal and invaluable. The winners. Fail faster, succeed sooner. David Kelly, founder, IDEO. Fail forward fast. High-tech CEO, Philadelphia, seminar participant. No matter, try again, fail better. Samuel Beckett. Ideas economy. Can your business fail fast enough to succeed? Advertisement. Economist conference. Success represents 1% of your work, which results only from the 99% that is called failure. Sachiro Honda. Now add a powerful twist. Reward excellent failures. Punish mediocre successes. Phil Daniels, successful businessman, Sydney. Actually, Daniels said in full, I owe my success to 6 words. Reward excellent failures, punish mediocre successes. I used this quote at a seminar for senior staff of a giant financial services company. The CEO came up to me afterwards and said with an almost violent head shake, "Tom, more than any other one thing you mentioned, I am bedeviled by the mediocre success phenomenon."